Okay, it is September 16th, 2010. We're at the offices of Wilmer Hale in Washington, D.C., interviewing Mr. Stanley O'Neill. Mr. O'Neill, my name is Chris Seifer. Myself and my two colleagues are from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009 that charges us with figuring out the various causes of the financial crisis by the end of the year and delivering a report by December 15th. That statute tells us to look at many things, including any institution that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of exceptional government assistance. Tells us to look at the issue of securitization. Those are two reasons why we are looking at Merrill Lynch, and those are two reasons why we, of course, thought it made sense to talk to you, since you were the CEO of Merrill Lynch for quite a long time. So with that, did counsel want to make a statement for the record before we get into the substance?
Hi, Chris. This is Reg Brown from Wilmer Hale, joined by Gail Ennis and Sarah Moore, representing Bank of America, which acquired Merrill Lynch. I've provided a letter to you regarding our views on the use of the information that's being provided to you today by third parties.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. O'Neill, could you please summarize your educational and work background, please, starting with college?
Sure. I received a Bachelor of Science from General Motors Institute and a MBA from Harvard University. And I began my career with General Motors in New York on the finance staff in 1978, and I was there until January of 87, when I joined Merrill Lynch as a vice president in leverage finance or high yield merchant banking group. And I spent the next close to 20 years at Merrill Lynch in various capacities over that time.
Okay, and can you just briefly summarize what those capacities were over time?
Initially, I was a vice president in the leverage finance group. I was made a managing director, I think, in 1990. I began managing that group in 91, and I was head of that group from 91 until 1995. I, along the way, was given and assumed additional responsibilities starting, I believe, in 1993, part of investment banking reported to me, and increasing parts of the investment banking organization reported to myself and other individuals. And then in 95, I was head of capital markets from 95 to 97, I believe, and in 97, head of the institutional business, capital markets business, co-head with a fellow named Tom Davis. And that job lasted for less than a year, about 10 months. I was asked to be chief financial officer, which I assumed that role in early 1998. And did that for about 2 years, and in early 2000 was asked to run the retail business at Merrill Lynch. And in August, I believe, of 2001, was named president and chief operating officer. And subsequently, I believe in December of 2002, CEO in addition to president. And later in 2003, first half of 2003, named chairman, in addition to CEO and president.
Okay, thank you. So, I'm going to do it a little different than maybe the council has told you before. Before I start asking about specifics about Merrill Lynch, let me tell you a couple of things we've seen. We've seen the growth of the institution over the decade of the 2000s, and we see when it gets to be late 06, early 07, that the company apparently started to pursue a de-risking strategy whereby it was attempting to reduce warehouse risk by constructing CDOs, retaining the super senior portions, and selling off the the subordinate tranches. We talked about that a little in the October 24, 2007 conference call when Merrill announced 3Q07 results. And then, of course, after you left at the end of October and November 2007, the company continued to report write-downs on those assets and other type assets, and eventually was acquired by B of A in the fourth quarter of 2008. With that lead-in, I'd like to first just ask you generally, what do you see as the primary causes of Merrill Lynch's problems that led to those losses in the second half of 2007 and throughout 2008?
I'm not sure I have a good answer for you because I left at the end of October, and from the beginning of the summer, sometime in July through August, September, and October, a lot of my time was absorbed dealing with crisis related to this and liquidity and disruption in the marketplace involving those assets, but it also had migrated to other assets as well and funding. So I never had a chance to do a full forensic analysis, to sit down with measured objectivity and time to sit down and talk to all the individuals who would have had various responsibilities at the firm, nor reflect very much, nor look at a lot of data or ask for additional information or clarification on things. So I'm not sure I'm the right person to answer that question. The other thing I would say is that I remember a meeting. This was a systemic event, as it turned out. So it wasn't limited to Merrill. It was on a vast scale, and Merrill obviously was affected by it. But it was not something that was isolated or particular to Merrill by any stretch of the imagination. And the other point I guess I would make is that I recall a meeting at the Federal Reserve that was hosted by Tim Geithner. I believe it was in the first half of 2007. It was a dinner. And Ben Bernanke was in town, and Hank Paulson was there as well, and other members of the Treasury and Federal Reserve staff. And there were representatives from virtually every major firm, financial firm in New York, as I recall. Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, J.P. Morgan, AIG, were all in the room, and the topic of discussion, more than anything else over that dinner, was systemic risk. What was the collective wisdom about where it might emanate from? What were people concerned about? What should be done to forestall it? And the discussion probably lasted something like 2 hours, and I can tell you that of all the things that were mentioned, my recollection is housing was never one of them. So you had a collection of people, different perspectives, different backgrounds, different firms, some different industries, but all financial services. And you had head of the Federal Reserve, you had head of the Federal Reserve in New York, you had Treasury Secretary. All, I think, people of diligence and intelligence and trying to do what was the right thing, and yet no one in that room perceived that housing could be the source of systemic risk. So I'm not sure I have a good answer.
Do you recall what people were saying they thought the systemic risk areas were?
The biggest part of the discussion centered on leveraged loans, which had grown dramatically across the entire street, was highly competitive. Pricing level relative to risk, most people felt, was out of line with historical standards, and there was some concern that there was systemic risk being built up across a whole host of balance sheets, not only here but also in Europe, as people competed for these loans. And there was plenty of liquidity. So it was highly concentrated, it was leveraged, and therefore by definition, highly concentrated, lower level in the capital structure of risk. And had migrated to the point, part of the discussion, I think, was about equity bridge loans. So banks had begun to lend against eventual equity investments. That's how far it had gone, and I think there was a general lament in the room that that was true. some of this I remember clearly because that's the part of the business I started in at Merrill.
Mm-hmm. And when you say this meeting was in the first half of 07, do you place it any more specifically than that?
No.
Not in first quarter, second quarter?
Okay. I think it was early in the year.
Okay. When you were talking about leverage loans and equity bridge loans, was that discussion in terms of the potential losses on those loans or the impact of losses on those loans in terms of the systemic implications?
Yes.
Okay. Any discussion about derivatives?
Some about derivatives, and some of that discussion was centered on processes and clearing and transparency.
Yes. And other than those types of discussions on derivatives, what else was discussed that you recall in terms of the systemic implications of derivatives?
Not a lot that I can recall.
Okay. Let me ask you, because it is something we've been looking at as a commission. Obviously, over-the-counter derivatives, you know, most, if not all, by definition, not on an exchange, not a lot of transparency. And I can tell you from some of the things we've been looking at, the Fed, including the Federal Reserve Bank in New York, didn't have a great idea about what was going on in the OTC derivatives market as opposed to, for example, the tri-party repo market, because they're Boney and JPMC are giving them the numbers at the end of every day. Mm-hmm. Jog any memory bells about concerns by the government or others on the street about the lack of transparency and what the counterparty risk was and the systemic implications were from OTC derivatives?
No.
What about, recall any discussion about systemic risks associated with the tri-party repo market?
Don't recall.
What were your thoughts then about what the main systemic risk areas were?
Well, I shared the concerns about the leverage loans. And part of that was, again, I had a background there. And these loans were all multi-billion dollars in size, and they were one name. So finding liquidity for them, if there was a problem, was always a difficult thing. So you had to be as comfortable as you could be with the quality of the credit, knowing that it was in large scale for every single name and difficult to sell. Mm-hmm. So that was a concern that I shared. I'm not sure I had any particular insights as to where the systemic risk might be building.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall any discussions, whether about systemic risk or asset classes, where there may be losses coming up in terms of real estate? I ask because at this time, whatever time it is in the first half of 07, mm-hmm. by 1Q07, Merrill was, from the documents we've seen, pursuing this de-risking strategy of trying to reduce the warehouse risk by constructing CDOs, retaining the super senior tranches, and getting rid of the subordinate tranches. Jog any memory bells in terms of discussion?
No, nope, not at all.
Okay. Do you recall that strategy at Merrill in terms of reducing warehouse risk by retaining the super seniors and selling the subordinate tranches?
I was told about it subsequently.
Okay. And when did you first learn about it, whether you were told about it or otherwise?
Sometime in July.
Board meeting?
No. There was a presentation that was prepared, I think, for the Finance Committee, and it was in the preparation of that presentation and that presentation, which I attended with the Finance Committee.
Was that presentation by Mr. Latazio by any chance?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. What do you recall about what he said?
Talked about this de-risking strategy, as I recall. talked about some negative trends that had emerged in the market for CDOs and mortgage products generally. And looked at... tried to quantify possible losses that would stem from that portfolio. And as I recall, those were relatively small losses that were quantified at the time. Nothing that would sound alarming.
Anticipated my next question. Who was on the risk committee that this presentation was made to? Do you recall.
No, it was a finance committee.
I'm sorry, finance committee.
The board, don't really recall the composition, but I think it was chaired by Charles Rosati. May have included Dan Reese. This is all board members.
Okay, that finance committee is a committee of the board.
Yes.
Okay. Other than Mr. Latazio and yourself, who are members of management, any other management people there?
I believe we would have had Tomas Fakahani in the room. I can't swear to this, but I think he would have been in the room. I think the chief financial officer would have been in the room, which is Jeff Edwards, who was generally at most of the finance committee meetings. We would have had someone from risk as well. And Osman Samirci probably would have been there. And I can't recall who else.
I remember if Ken was there.
He had left the firm by then.
You're right. What was the reaction of you? What was your reaction to learning about this for the first time in July of 2007?
Well, as I said, the presentation and the analysis and the estimation of potential losses was not sufficient to ring any alarm bells. But I was surprised at the size of the position.
Do you recall what the size of the position was?
No.
Did they present both the gross and net exposures? Do you recall?
Don't recall. Okay.
Why were you surprised?
Well, it's my conception of the business was an agent of business, so I would have expected that the amount of underwriting would have been geared to market receptivity. I mean, I grew up in a business at Merrill where we underwrote high-yield securities. And when I ran the business, it was trying to make sure that whatever we originated, we could also sell. You couldn't always do that. You couldn't do it immediately. And therefore, just being in the business had a certain amount of inventory attached to it. But you could control the amount of inventory by how much underwriting you did. And that was the nature of the business as far as I was concerned.
Sure. I will tell you that other folks we've talked to that used to work at Merrill have said that the CDO business was always intended to be, as you said, originate and sell,
right.
not retain. That started to change in late 2006. What did Mr. Latazio or anyone else at the meeting who was presenting, what was their explanation for the retained positions given that belief of what the business was?
Market conditions, and we started the process after that, Fakahani did, trying to understand how we had gotten to where we wound up. That ultimately led to Osman and Dale's departure in early October, I believe.
And I know Osman is Mr. Samirci, and Dale is
Latanzi.
Okay. And I'm sorry, I just didn't hear you. And they left when?
I think at the end of September or early October.
And that was a result of Mr. Fakahani looking into how Merrill had come to
and
get
how
exposure.
And how, I think generally, how the process was being managed after we became aware of the size of the positions.
Okay, so were Mr. Samirci and Latanzio, is that Latanzio or Latazio?
I don't know.
Fair enough. Dale.
Right.
were they terminated or did they resign?
I don't know technically how it was classified, but they were asked to leave.
Okay. So what did Mr. Fakahani's analysis result in? What do you recall?
Well, he asked a couple of people, as I recall, to look back and see when and how this buildup took place. And it apparently, as you said, started sometime in late 2006, but really accelerated in early 07, and as I recall, was almost done by April of 07, and didn't really increase much after that. So it was all under Samurchi's and Latanzia's watch. And I think the other finding was that as we began to struggle with how to mitigate or manage the position, Amas Fakahani became uncomfortable with the process that was taking place and how open or transparent it was, and he wasn't as comfortable with their leadership as time went on as he had been earlier.
How was the process not transparent?
I can't remember all the details. Maybe not involving everyone that he thought should be involved at, in a timely fashion. Complete information. I'm not sure at this stage.
You find out about this during this July 2007 meeting. What kind of reports, if any, did you receive before that time on the CDO business?
Nothing that I can recall specifically. I mean, look, the business was, I think our revenue at the peak was about $38 billion, and this business was probably about 2% of total revenue. Balance sheet was $1 trillion, or somewhere thereabouts. And I would guess that these assets were less than 1% of the size, maybe substantially less than 1% of the size, even at the peak. And there are thousands, there were literally thousands and thousands of categories of different types of securities and inventory and subcategories.
Understanding that the business was a small percentage of revenue and total assets, did you get reports that showed the exposure of the CDO business or other business as a percentage of capital? Because I will tell you that the retained positions of the, I think you reported, that's what I was just looking at least your GAAP capital, as of the end of '06, $39 billion, end of '07, $32 billion, and as you may recall, the net ABS CDO exposure, I think, was in the low to mid 30s, like by the first quarter of 2007.
That we recall, but the risk position is not the same as inventory. I mean, inventory is one number, and another is the measure of risk inherent in that inventory. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. But the first thing is, this was a, in my mind, it was an agented business.
Right.
So I believed that we were originating and selling what we originated. And we weren't actually even originating. We were buying in the secondary origination market. We were buying from originators up until we bought First Franklin.
Right.
But even then, as I recall, most of the mortgages that we packaged were third-party originated. Vast majority of them. So we were buying and packaging and reselling. And so inherently there was warehouse risk and there was some lag risk, but it should not have been all that significant. And if the standards for the quality of the paper that we were buying were upheld, the risk would have been contained by that as well. Mm-hmm. That turned out not to be the case, but there was no evidence, no reason for me day to day to know that that was true.
Okay. When you found out in July that you did have these larger exposures, whether it's the warehouse, whether it's retained positions, or both, do you recall finding out at that time that the strategy included the, let me start over. Do you recall learning at that time that the increase in the retained positions was the result of a strategy to construct CDOs, as you said, on October 24th, 2007, to reduce the warehouse risk, sell off the subordinate tranches, and keep the super seniors?
I think that something of that nature was described in that presentation.
Okay. Do you recall any discussion about why the super seniors were being retained?
Because they couldn't be sold. So, but the real question, I think, given what you just said, is why was the warehouse so big?
So what did they say about why the warehouse was so big?
and there were no good answers.
Well, understanding they weren't good, what were they?
I don't recall. I mean, it just, if it was a good answer, I would have recalled what the or memorable answer was.
Fair enough. Why couldn't the super seniors be sold? Anything could be sold at a certain price, right?
No. But I was chief financial patrol officer in 97 and 98. Oh, I'm sorry, 98 and 99. And there were periods of time in the middle of 98 when certain things couldn't be sold at any price. And lots of different things couldn't be sold at any price.
So help the non-Wall Street guy understand that one of the things that I haven't been able to figure out is if you're able to sell the subordinate tranches, why can't you sell the supposedly safer AAA tranches?
I'm not knowledgeable enough about that market and what the dynamics were in the first half of 07 to give you an answer, but I do know for sure that there are moments in time when certain assets can't be sold at all. And there are moments in time, from my experience, when lots of assets can't be sold at all at any price. There's just no bid.
And do you recall any discussion or explanation in the July or later time frame before you leave about why the super seniors could not be sold?
No, I don't recall.
Do you recall, though, that it was said that they could not be sold as opposed to they can't be sold at a price that we're willing to sell them at?
No.
Do you recall whether or not anyone said we're not selling them because if we sold them, we take a loss?
No. And again, as I recall that presentation, the estimates of the losses inherent in the portfolio was relatively modest. So if there was a sale, what that would have implied is that the price at which they would ultimately be sold wouldn't have produced very significant losses.
But I guess it sort of begs the question, doesn't it? I mean, if they...
Right? I agree.
Okay, so in July 2007, you find this out for the first... Well, before I move on, what are the reactions of others to this? And when I say others, the others on the committee, the other board members on the committee.
I don't recall a lot of the discussion, but again, the presentation would leave you with a relatively contained picture of what the potential losses would be. Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned that other management folk at the July meeting, including Mr. Fakahani, Mr. Edwards, Mr. Smirchi, somebody from Risk. Do you recall whether or not Mr. Fakahani knew about the exposures before the July 2007 meeting?
I don't believe he did, but I can't answer for him.
Okay, and same question for Mr. Edwards?
I don't believe he did, but I can't answer for him.
Okay, same question for Mr. Smirchi.
I can't answer for him either.
Right. And I'm just, to the extent you recall from the meeting, I mean, since Mr. Smirchi is in that department.
Right. And it reports to him, but I can't speak to his state of mind or what he knew or what he didn't.
Sure. And you don't recall any discussions or any statements by Smirchi or any of the others, being part of the presentation to say here's how it happened that would indicate they knew about it.
No, I wouldn't characterize it at this stage because I just don't have a clear enough memory of the whole discussion.
Okay. Now, you had mentioned that during this meeting there was no reason for alarm. They indicated the losses were okay, or that they weren't high. On October 5th, Merrill Lynch issues the press release pre-announcing 3Q07 results, or at least pre-announcing that they expected to take about a $4.5 billion write-down on the ABS CDOs. And then, of course, on October 24th, you announced, I think, $7.9 billion in write-down, $6.9 of which was on the ABS CDOs and some of the warehouse, the other billion being on non-ABS subprime exposure. When do you learn that after July of 07 that there was reason for alarm?
Well, we began to take write-downs on this inventory, I think, in July, in our monthly P&L, and we took further write-downs, larger write-downs, I can't remember the quantities, in August. And then as we got into September, the models that were being run, which is all this was based on the basis of models, because there was no market at the time, there was no bid, so, and there were no transactions being done. So all the valuations were based on a series of assumptions that were plugged into a model, which would have included things like GDP growth, unemployment, default rates, and losses on defaults. And by the time we got to September, the amount of indicated breakdowns had accumulated to a point where we thought it was important, large enough, and important enough to pre-announce as opposed to wait until the end of the quarter. So we did our best to estimate what those losses were. We reported it at, I forget what date you said it was, but early October.
October 5th. I'm sorry, go ahead. I didn't interrupt you.
I'm sorry. So when did we become aware? It was a dawning awareness over the course of the summer and in through September as the size of the losses that were being estimated grew.
And you recall what was driving that growing estimate?
Assumptions that were being put in about losses that ultimately could be realized on the portfolio.
And you recall specifically what assumptions that were being put in the models were driving it?
Yeah. And this was, it would have been the expectations for negative economic scenario would have been heightened by disruption in the marketplace in August when the interbank market auction failed in Europe and liquidity began to tighten and the markets began to deteriorate more broadly. That had some impact on the perception of what the appropriate inputs to the model would be, and they became increasingly negative.
Are you having any discussions with folks outside of Maryland, sort of, you know, industry, you know, counterparts in the other banks about what's going on in the industry, given what you're seeing in your CDO book at this time? Or with the Fed, like folks in the Fed?
Definitely with the Fed, yes.
Can you generally describe those discussions, who you're talking to, when, what's being discussed?
Jeez, it's like a blur. I remember Hank Paulson calling me on the same day, I think, that the auction failed in the interbank market in Europe, and asking me what my perception was and how I saw things. And I told him, you know, they have turned increasingly negative since that event, because that was a signal that this was there was a negative tone in the marketplace that was much greater than I had perceived. And we talked about that. We talked about liquidity a lot over the course of the next few weeks, how to ensure sufficient liquidity in the system, what measures the Fed might take to spur and promote liquidity. One of the things that was focused on was providing more liquidity to the money center banks in the hopes that they would, because the repo market had tightened up, as I recall. So we talked about those things. I don't know what else, but those are some of the things that I remember. Mm-hmm.
You may recall that in July 2007, the rating agencies did a fairly massive downgrade of a lot of RMBS. Did that have any impact on either the way you folks were modeling the losses on the CDOs or generally your view on the credit quality of those CDOs?
I can't tell you specifically what, you know, drove the assumptions that were put into the model. That wasn't something I did. So there were, you know, people in finance and people in risk and people who ran the business and the collected body looking at how these securities ought to be appropriately valued, and it was all based on assumptions, and I think everyone was struggling to find the right set of assumptions.
You mentioned you were one of the areas you discussed with Mr. Paulson when he called was liquidity. What do you recall talking to him in terms of liquidity?
That the repo market was very important. It had become extremely tight and very short in duration. Term repo was almost non-existent, and that situation was very fragile. and I think he was hearing this from a lot of people, and he knew this to be the case. And as I said, ultimately there was a plan that was devised to provide more liquidity to the money center banks, and they were supposed to open the floodgates and liquidity returned, would return to the markets. It was unclear, as I recall, how well that worked. And I think I left before the whole thing played out.
So before, any time before you left Merrill, was Merrill having problems of obtaining repo financing?
Yes, I think every firm on the street was. Anything longer than a few days.
But I'm trying to distinguish actually getting the financing or as opposed to the terms of the financing. I understand it was much shorter in duration.
We were always able to fund ourselves, if that's the question you're asking. It's just that the duration was short, and the window of collateral, as I recall, that was acceptable was narrowing. And because we, like everyone else, depended to a significant degree on repo financing, and there was no practical substitute for the size and scale of repo financing for any of the firms that participated in the market, it was just critical that the repo market continued to function. It did, but it was very tight.
I don't recall, was it Boney or J.P. Morgan that was your tri-party repo? Do you remember?
No.
Do you remember if whoever it was, whether they were requiring larger haircuts for the non-treasury or agency type securities?
I don't recall, but I believe, this is what I was referring to earlier, I think across the board for virtually every firm, the terms had tightened and the acceptable range of collateral had narrowed. And I can't tell you specifically beyond that.
Sure. Thank you.
We had a liquidity plan that we had put in place long before where we relied a lot less on short-term funding and more on long-term funding. And we had some contingency plans in place, and we began to make sure that we would have as much liquidity as possible to last us as long as possible. And as I recall, those efforts bore fruit, and we never faced a liquidity crisis during the time that I was there.
Okay. Okay, let's go back earlier in Merrill's time. One of the things, again, that we've seen is from 2002 to 2007, you guys go from about 440 billion assets to about a trillion in assets by the end of the year, understanding you're not there until the end of the year. And I think you told me that you became CEO in December of 2002, President COO in August of 2001. Was there a conscious strategy to grow the company in the 2002 to 2007 time frame?
Well, I think, first of all, the as I recall, the business, the whole environment was pretty bad in 2001, just generally. And then on top of that, we had September 11th, which made it worse. We had the bursting of the internet bubble. We had a huge amount of business that was geared towards equity and equity underwriting and equity sales and trading, and a lot of that was driven by the tech bubble that turned out to be a bubble. And when that all exploded, I think everybody's business was affected. Ours may have been affected more. And we had a much bigger cost base and a much bigger footprint and a much less productive set of businesses than it needed to be and could have been and should have been. And then September 11th happened, and as a result of that, we actually had to move out of our headquarters beginning on September 11th, and we didn't really get back into our headquarters until December, I believe. So during all that time, the business was greatly disrupted because we were conducting trading in makeshift offices scattered all around the city. So we would have been at a very depressed point, I think, for a whole host of reasons in the beginning of 2002. The industry overall, I think, was way down, and we had been affected to a significant degree more than others. And we had embarked on a restructuring program in 2001. And through a lot of 2002, where we sold businesses, we closed down businesses, we reduced the size and scale of other businesses. So the balance sheet that you're starting with, I think, in 2002, certainly I know the business was greatly diminished in 2002 from what it had been. And the market environment started to reflate fairly dramatically across the board in 2003. Business grew dramatically and across most segments of everybody's business in 2003. It continued on with a little bit of interruption in 2004 and then took off again in 2005 and 2006. So I think some of what you're seeing, I think, relates to a particular low point in the market environment and low point in activity, and a especially low point in our businesses. And you're looking at a shrunken version of what Merrill had been before that, to one that was rebuilding a set of capabilities from a base that had been intentionally shrunk. And the other thing I would say is that there were whole businesses that we didn't participate in 2001. So, for example, commodity trading. We didn't have a prime brokerage business in equities, for securities trading firms. And there were a whole list of businesses like that we just didn't participate in, which we began to build after we had shrunk the size of many other businesses and exited other businesses. So I think part of what you're seeing is the environment reflating changes from a very low point, Merrill moving from an even lower point and beginning to enter businesses that we hadn't been in.
Well, and I take it that was a conscious choice to enter businesses that you hadn't been in before.
Yes. And the reason for that is that if you're going to be a global player who serves clients, investing and trading clients, and investment banking clients, having the right set of capabilities in order to serve those clients was essential to being able to serve those clients well.
Okay. Again, another thing we've seen is, I think in 2003 is when Mr. Ricciardi is retained or hired by Merrill, and then from that point on, Merrill goes from, depending on what numbers you look at, but generally goes from being not a big player in CDO issuances to being the number one player in CDO issuances, at least in the years 04, 05, 06, and depending on the chart you're looking at, either one or two in the first half of 2007. Mm-hmm. What do you recall of anything about the decision to, one, hire Mr. Ricciardi and two, grow the CDO business?
Well, I do recall Dow Kim, among many different parts of his businesses, advocating for being in that business, for the reason similar to what I just said to you, which is that we had a lot of clients who saw the CDO market and mortgage market as an integral part of their investing and trading strategy, and we had no ability to have a dialogue with them or add any value to that part of their portfolio, and we thought it was important that we change that. And he hired the person to do that.
Did you have any discussions with Mr. Kim or understand otherwise why there was an increased demand for the CDO investment by clients?
Sure, I did at some point in time. If you're talking about going back to the time frame in which we made the decision to do that, that would have been 7 years ago. It's a little hard to recall specific conversations 7 years ago.
But just generally, I mean, do you recall, any discussions or from anything you read at the time about, why there was an increased demand from investors for collateralized debt obligations?
I think it would have had to do with an ability to diversify the portfolio, their portfolio, and enhancing yield with a structure that provided relatively low beta assets.
And just so for anybody who may be listening to the tape, when you say a low beta, what does that mean?
Low volatility.
Thank you. Okay, so in the 2003 through the time you leave in 2007, or at least until July 2007, what kind of written reports do you receive that, you know, include information on the growth in the CDO business, the profitability of the CDO business, et cetera? Understanding, as you said earlier, that it wasn't a big source, at least in percentage terms, of the company's overall revenues.
I can't tell you that I recall that specifically for CDOs.
Understanding you can't recall specifically, were there reports you received that would have included that information, do you know?
I think so, yes.
Okay.
But I can't tell you what that was or what it looked like, what the content was. Or
am I correct in assuming that during board meetings there would be a presentation of the company's financial results?
Absolutely.
Okay. And would those presentations, let me back up, before board meetings, would a board package be distributed to the various board members?
Always.
Okay. And would those board packages include some type of financial report?
Always.
Okay. And generally, what kind of information was in the financial report?
It'd be a report on earnings, report on firm's overall financial position, highlighting trends and issues and developments since the last board meeting.
Would it include P&L information on specific business lines within the segments of the company?
Oh, God. I think if you went down to the P&L level for every business we had, you would have had hundreds of P&Ls, and it would have been difficult for anybody to find that very useful information, I think, at the board level.
Okay. So understanding that there may not have been P&Ls for hundreds of business lines, how granular did it get, do you recall?
No.
Okay. And then in addition to the written section of the board report that board members would get before the meeting, then I take it someone, probably the CFO, probably presented the financial report at the board meeting?
Yes.
Okay. Would managers from other business lines within the company present the results of their business lines?
Generally speaking, yes, but there would typically be some selection of emphasis for a particular board meeting. So one executive might come and talk about a particular area for an hour or hour and a half or whatever it was, as opposed to every executive talking about every part of their business at every board meeting.
Your meeting would go all day, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, and I'm not sure how useful that would be in terms of trying to orient the board to what was happening within the business.
Mm-hmm. And just trying to get an idea of who's making the presentations. Is, for example, Mr. Kim making presentations on the businesses that he's in charge of, or people below him? You know,
we had, I don't know, I can recall lots of different people making presentations. So Dow Kim made some presentations. Jeff Gronfeld made some presentations. Osmond at various junctures made presentations. Rohit D'Souza, who ran equities, made presentations. Kevin Dunleavy, who ran our hedge fund business, made presentations. I mean, lots of different executives had access to the board.
Okay. Do you recall at the time, in the 2003, 4, 5, 6 time frame, that Merrill had become the number one CDO issuer?
Yes, I recall us being a leader in the CDO business.
Okay, and was that a goal of the company to become number one in CDO?
What am I going? I mean, as a matter of fact, one of the things I was heavily criticized for when I first became CDO by people who had been part of Merrill for previous years was that I got rid of the notion that we had to be number one in businesses because there was no particular there was no particular benefit necessarily to being number one in the business. So I'll give you an example. Our, for I think maybe two decades, certainly for one decade, we were number one underwriter of corporate bonds. Well, you know, when we began the process of being number one underwriter of corporate bonds, it probably had some meaning to it in terms of our client base, because we were supplying them with product that they wanted to buy, and we were winning against competition that wasn't just based on price. As time went on, it became more commoditized, less about having the right kinds of relationships, the right kind of distribution capability, being able to deliver value in terms of research and so forth, and it became more about what price were you willing to pay for the corporate bond issuance. So you could have no more share, but it didn't necessarily mean anything to clients, and it didn't necessarily mean anything in the context of the business. And we had a lot of businesses where we had a mindset that you had to be number one. And that was something I didn't think was right. I didn't think it was beneficial to Merrill. I didn't think it was beneficial to our client base. And I thought it distorted profitability and distorted incentives.
Okay. You mentioned it wasn't your goal to become the number one CDO issuer. Whose was it?
I don't know that it was a goal.
Okay.
I never discussed the business in those terms.
In February 06, or about February 06, Mr. Ricciardi leaves Merrill Lynch to go to, I think, Cullen and Company. Do you recall that?
I recall that he left. Before you said when he left, I'm not sure I could have told you when that was.
Okay. Do you know why he left?
No.
Okay. Do you have any discussions with him when he left?
I don't recall having.
Do you recall?
My impression was that this was a good client of his and it was a good opportunity for him. That was the reason I thought that he left, but I can't tell you for sure.
You may have seen in the financial press reports that after he leaves in February 2006 that Mr. Kim, you know, said we're going to do whatever it takes to maintain our number one position as CDO issuer. Do you recall Mr. Kim saying anything like that or having discussions with him in that regard?
No.
Putting aside whether or not you recall discussing with Mr. Kim, do you recall whether or not it was a goal or objective within Merrill Lynch to retain the number one, to be the number one CDO issuer after Mr. Ricciardi left?
Given what I said to you about my philosophy and what I had dismantled before, it would have been inconsistent for anybody to be talking to me about a business for the purpose of being number one, just to have an objective of being number one for the purpose of being number one. It has no particular rationale to it that makes any business sense.
So in about, I think, June or July of 2006, there's a reorganization within Merrill Lynch where I think Mr. Cronthal and Mr. Mac Taylor and others whose names I can't remember right now leave the company. And I think that's when Mr. Simerci moves up to take over Mr. Cronthal's position. Did you have any, what do you recall about that? And
well, that's not exactly accurate. I don't think what
tell
you
me how
said.
It's inaccurate, please.
Well, first of all, Osmond didn't take Cronthal's job. He filled a job that didn't exist at Merrill until that point. So maybe a little bit of history.
Please.
In 2003, if I recall correctly, I named Dow Kim head of all global markets, which was fixed income, sales and trading, as well as equity sales and trading. And he and I had a discussion at the time about whether or not we would appoint heads of the equity business and heads of the fixed income business underneath him, as opposed to having smaller businesses that made up each of those businesses report directly to him. And he made the case, and I ultimately agreed with him, that he wanted to get to that point at some point in the future. But for two reasons, he thought it was not the optimal structure at the beginning. One was that our businesses were so small, and there were lots of businesses that we were not in. He felt that he needed to be able to be very close to each of those businesses, and he also wanted a chance to evaluate the people in each of them. close to those businesses without a line of reporting between he and the smaller components of the business. That was number one. Number two, he wasn't convinced that we had the right people internally to occupy those roles, and he wanted time to evaluate and see whether someone could emerge or whether he thought it was going to be necessary to go outside. And indeed, we did go outside to hire Rohit D'Souza, eventually to head up equities, that filled that slot. And for a time longer, we left, I don't remember when we hired Rohit from Morgan Stanley, but for a time longer, the fixed income position remained open. And that was, that's an unusual structure. One that couldn't be sustained over a long period of time, and the business had gotten to a point where I thought we needed to fill the job, and Dow thought the same thing around the same time. We started having discussions about putting someone in charge of fixed income. There was a recognition on his part that not everyone would be happy with that, that having had a direct reporting relationship to him for a number of years, people wouldn't then be happy or as happy about being pushed down one level in the organization reporting to someone else. He looked at internal candidates, and so we had an expectation that there was some risk that there could be some departures as a result of changing the organization. He looked at internal candidates, looked at external candidates, recommended Osman. My understanding is that Kronthal decided he did not want to work, did not want to report through Osman to Dow, as opposed to reporting directly to Dow, and perhaps believed that he should have gotten the nod for that job himself. I can't say. I didn't have a discussion with him. And he left. So Osman didn't get, if you will, his job. That was a structural change in a job that hadn't existed at Merrill for some time and had existed previously. And it was put back in place because the business had gotten to a point where we thought it was necessary. And as for Matt Taylor's departure, I mean, I could be totally misremembering, but I thought he had left well before this.
Reggie, 1 second. And just to close it out, I think you want to take a break.
Yeah.
We've heard, and I just want to see if the dog's memory goes, that Kronthal was told by Kim that in the reorg there was not a position for him. Not that Kronthal didn't want to report to Kim through Sumerji, but that Kim told Kronthal there's no position for you here.
Well, that's not my understanding.
Okay.
So I don't know if you got that directly from Kronthal. But
I did.
And if you talked to Dow, I got his side of the story, but that's not my understanding of what happened.
Okay. Take a break.
Yeah, be great. Can you give me one of those?
What? My internal incomplete draft.
Okay.
Sorry, go ahead. So I wanted to talk to you about the risk management function at Merrill. Can you initially generally describe how the risk management section dissects the risk management function was set up at Merrill, reporting relationships, et cetera?
If I recall correctly, we had one person in charge of credit and one in charge of risk, both reporting to the CFO. Which was the same structure that I had when I was chief financial officer.
And was that the case from 2002 until you left in 2007?
No, I honestly don't recall, but I'm sure it evolved more than one direction over that time. And it wasn't the case before I was CFO.
Okay. So in the 2006-2007 time frame, was that the way it was structured?
I think so, although I can't tell you for sure because Amos's role changed during that time frame. When he was for some period of time he was chief financial officer, and then he had the chief financial officer reporting to him, and in April or so, May of the next year, he was president. So I don't really recall all the changes over the course of time in the organizational structure.
And when you say Amos, you mean Mr. Fakahani?
Mr. Fakahani.
Okay. Who was the chief risk officer in 2006-2007?
I don't know that we had that title at that time.
So explain to me who the...
But the person who was overall responsible for the risk would have been the chief financial officer, which is the same as when I was chief financial officer. I didn't have that title, but I had responsibility for those risk organizations reported to me.
So Mr. Edwards in 2006-2007 would have had, as you said, the credit function and the risk function reporting up to him?
Right.
Okay. And who was the head of the credit and risk that reported to Mr. Edwards, do you recall, in 2006-07?
Credit, I think, would have been Ed Moriarty, and risk would have been Hatsuko. And I just know everybody called him by his first name, so I can't remember his
and name. And I've actually seen the last name,
right.
So that's fair. Thank you. I've heard of an individual named John Bright. Does that name ring a bell?
Yes.
And was he Mr. Was he Hatsuko's predecessor?
I believe so, but I don't recall for sure.
Okay. In July of 07, when you find out about the retained positions on the CEOs, did you have any discussions with Mr. Edwards, since the credit and the risk functions are reporting under him, about why didn't I know about this before?
At some juncture, I'm sure I did. I can't recall specific conversations at this point.
And understanding you can't recall specific conversations, do you recall generally what either Mr. Moriarty, Mr. Edwards, or Hatsuko said in terms of whether they knew about the increase in the retained positions?
No.
Okay. Do you recall if you ever had any, let me just go through each one, do you recall if you had any discussions with Mr. Hatsuko about whether or not he knew about the increase in the retained positions?
I don't recall.
The same thing for Mr. Moriarty?
Same thing.
Same thing for Mr. Edwards?
Yep.
Thank you. Was that a risk management failing?
Sorry?
Was that a risk management failure, not having them report up the retained positions to the CEO? Or to the CFO, for that matter?
Not report up through... They did report through the CFO.
No, I mean the specific point of the increase in the retained positions, of the CEO positions.
Well, if... I think if you looked across firms across the street over... 10, 15 year period of time, you see every conceivable structure. Before I was made CFO in 98, we had a chief risk officer reporting directly to the CEO, the chairman. And in 98, we had a crisis that hurt the firm badly. And had it lasted longer than it did, which was only a few months, we would have had... We had a lot more trouble than we wound up having. In that case, the reporting structure, which was different from the one I just described, and the one that we subsequently, I was asked to take on the risk as CFO. And that structure, I don't know. Structure alone, I guess, is insufficient. And certainly it was not sufficient in that case. And it was a completely different structure.
Looking back, any lessons learned on risk management in terms of the ABS CDOs or other exposures at Merrill during your time?
You know, as I said, I haven't. I left late October and of 07, and I have not had the benefit of being able to go back and sit down and talk to everyone who was involved and look at data in detail and reflect on it. So I'm not sure that I'm the right person to get lessons learned from.
When you learned in July of 07 about the retained positions and the fact that Merrill
Merrill was retaining the super senior and selling the subordinate. Did you look into at all or hear about who the subordinate positions were being sold to?
No.
Okay. Maybe you may have seen in the financial press or otherwise, and we've seen in some of the documents and information produced by Merrill, that in the late 06 and 07 time frame, a lot of the subordinate positions of CDOs that Merrill is selling are being sold to collateral managers that Merrill retained to manage other CDOs that they issue. Were you aware of that?
No.
Why did you retire on October 30th?
Because after extensive discussions with the board, it was agreed that I should retire and move on. I would look for a new chief executive officer.
And who did you have those discussions with on the board?
A number of board members.
In the October 30th press release, I think it was, it stated Mr. O'Neill and the Board of Directors both agreed that a change in leadership would best enable Merrill to move forward and focus on maintaining a strong operating performance of its businesses, which the company last week reported were performing well, apart from the subprime mortgages and the CDOs. Why? Can you give me any more color on that, on why you and the board felt that would best, that your retirement would best enable Merrill to move forward and focus on maintaining a strong operating performance of the businesses?
I think you have to ask the board.
Well, didn't, this is saying, and I thought I heard you say that it was a joint decision.
It was.
So why did you think that?
Because I thought it was time for me to move on and let somebody else take charge of the problem.
And why do you think it was time to move on?
It grew out of my discussion with the board.
Okay, but why did you think it was time to move on?
In part because I thought they thought it was time to move on.
Did you, after you retired, I think it was effective end of October, right? Regardless.
Somewhere around there.
Right. Did you have any contact with Merrill after you did retire?
No.
Changing topics to compensation. Can you explain to me what your philosophy was in terms of the compensation structure of Merrill when you were CEO?
For?
You mean time frame?
No. What
individual
generally. Or groups of individuals? There's some very big differences, for example.
For the brokers
senior
management
versus
okay.
Senior management. We there were objectives. There were objectives that were agreed upon at the beginning of each year and reviewed over the course of the year that related to specific things that we wanted to achieve as a firm. Those were part of the evaluation. The firm's overall performance was probably the most significant part for senior executives. And all of that was evaluated with a subjective judgment that was reached on the basis of objective criteria. Recommendations were made to the Compensation Committee of the Board, and the Compensation Committee of the Board approved those, sometimes changed them.
Did the compensation committee ever lower the comp that was recommended to it in 2006-2007?
I recall I had on one or two occasions, the numbers being lower. Maybe more.
How did you or the board or the comp committee determine that the composition of compensation, the breakdown between salary, bonus, stock, and any other parts of comp?
It was pre-established. So for all the most senior executives, 50% was in cash and 50% was in stock and stock-related compensation.
And just generally, how did you come to that decision?
I don't recall all the considerations, but the philosophy was basically that every senior executive should have some stake in the company, significant stake in the company, and a significant stake in the company's performance. So these stock awards were pretty significant each year. They didn't vest right away. They vested over, I think, a 3 or 4 year time frame. And they were at risk in terms of value during that period of time.
Do you recall whether or not there were any clawback provisions in any of the deferred comp?
Well, you know, if you have a stock option that's priced at $66 and the stock trades down to $30, in effect, whatever the notional dollar value of that stock option was at the time it was awarded goes to zero. And in effect, to me, that is a clawback.
Other than losing value if the stock price goes down, do you recall any discussions at the board or comp committee level about having clawback provisions in the compensation program?
Well, to me, it's not just losing value. I mean, if the way the option grant worked is there was a calculated value of the option based on a model. It said it was the equivalent of 3 shares, but the price, the value, ultimately depended on the strike price at the time the option is exercised. If the stock price is underwater, the option's worth zero. Not just the decline of value completely go away. And as for shares, the shares trade down or up and as much as the market dictated that that would be over time. And as I said, there was a stricture on retention, or sorry, vesting for a 3 or 4 year period of time. And then after that, there was a rule that we voluntarily put in place, which is that we would continue on 75% of the award. So I think there was a lot of accumulated compensation at risk for all the senior executives. Certainly, I think if you asked them, they would say that they felt that that was true.
Mm-hmm. And understanding that, that certainly there was risk of stock going down because of the vesting and, two, because of the voluntary agreement to keep 75%. Do you recall, anyway, whether there were any discussions about other types of clawback provisions for the comp program?
No, we don't.
I take it, let me just ask, did Merrill retain compensation consultants to help it come up with its comp programs?
Yes, I think so. Yes, they're definitely different periods of time.
And do you recall if any of them ever recommended or discussed whether or not clawback provision should be part of the comp program?
Don't recall.
I know generally that compensation consultants retained by companies are disclosed in the company's proxy statements in that area to talk about that. Do you recall if any were retained that were not disclosed in those proxy statements?
No.
Going back to the 2007 time frame, I believe in May 2007, Mr. Kim leaves the organization. Do you recall the circumstances under which he left?
Yeah, he came to me a few weeks later, earlier rather, and said he wanted to start a hedge fund.
Accurate to say that when he comes and says he's leaving in May of 07, given the meeting where you learn about the ABS CDOs is until July of 07, you don't know about the increased retained positions at the point that Mr. Kim leaves, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And did he ever bring that, I don't know the answer to this, but did he ever mention that to you before the time he left in May of 07?
No.
Okay. Did you ever have any discussions with Mr. Kim about the CDO portfolio after he left?
No.
Did you ever have any discussions with Mr. Kim at all after he left?
I think I had maybe one conversation with him where he, at the time he said he wanted to form this hedge fund, he said he hoped that Merrill would consider making an investment. And sometime after he had officially departed, I think, we had a conversation where I told him that we weren't inclined to make the investment.
Ballpark, you recall when that was?
No.
Okay. Was it before you left Merrill?
Yes.
Okay. Before that conversation, had Merrill, had you or anyone at Merrill said, we will make an investment in your hedge fund?
No.
Okay. You don't recall saying you'd make a $2 billion investment in this hedge fund?
I think what someone said was that we would look at the opportunity and make a decision. We would consider it. When he came to me with the announcement, and the first conversation we had about in April, I don't know how far along he was, but he had nothing to present, so it would be hard to make a decision based on no business plan.
When he came to you and said he wanted a lead to start a hedge fund, did you try to get him to stay?
Yes.
And obviously not successful, but why? How did you try to get him to stay?
I asked him 10 ways.
I won't ask you the list of 10 minutes.
That's an estimate.
Now, when he left in May of 07, do you have any discussions with him about what his comp would be in 2007 or what his retirement package would be at that time?
No.
Okay. Do you recall any discussions? Let me start over. We have heard that Mr. Kim believed that a rule of 60s requirement was going to be waived and that he would receive ballpark $15 million in retirement money. And that was his understanding when he left in May, and that later on, that didn't happen, and he didn't receive it. Any recollection of that topic?
No.
Okay. Do you ever have any discussions? It's right that I asked it. Do you have any discussions with Mr. Fain about his hiring as CEO by the company?
I had one meeting with Mr. Fain after it had been announced that he was to be the CEO. I don't know if he had officially started.
Okay. So I take it that means that you were not involved in his selection as CEO?
I was not involved in his selection.
Okay. And what did you discuss with Mr. Fain when you met with him?
He had reached out to me, I don't recall exactly how, whether it was direct or indirect or through email or something, but, and asked if I would spend some time with him. And I agreed. And we met, it wasn't a very long meeting. He asked me a few questions, and I tried to the best of my ability to answer those.
And do you recall the topics that you discussed?
He asked me some questions about some of the senior executives. He asked me about the board. He asked me about Merrill, the state of Merrill, and what had happened and why. And I don't know what topics beyond that.
In terms of what happened at Merrill and why, what did you tell him?
I told him I wasn't the right person to answer that question.
And why weren't you the right person to answer that question?
Because I hadn't had this is sort of what I said earlier. Of all the things I did the last 3 months I was there, I hadn't had a chance to sit down and reflect, and investigate thoroughly, and understand, and do analysis and come to conclusions. It was sort of a whirlwind. So I thought that would the question could better be answered by somebody with distance and more time. and continuing access.
How did he respond to that?
I don't recall that he said anything.
Okay. What did you tell him about senior executives?
I gave him a thumbnail sketch of the people that he asked me about.
I mean, did he ask you, who's good, who's bad?
No, he didn't ask that way. He just said, tell me what you think of this person, what you think of that person.
I know just from looking at the conference call transcripts that he brought in an individual named Nelson Chai, or Kai, I don't know how it's pronounced, as CFO. Do you recall discussing with Mr. Fain, Mr. Edwards at all?
No.
Did Mr. Edwards leave when you left?
No.
He left after?
Yeah, I think so.
And what do you call discussing with Mr. Fain about the board?
Not much. I told them that whatever my perceptions or relationship with the board was, it would be a different one for him, and it would evolve for him over time. So it wasn't for me to say.
Can you generally describe, your interaction with the board of directors and how the board of directors was or was not engaged with the oversight of management?
I think the board was engaged. The board was very engaged, and my relationship with the board was a very constructive and open one for my entire tenure there.
So let me ask you, as it does, and I know it probably hasn't been completely enjoyable me asking you about the things that went wrong at Merrill on the ABS CDOs. Tell me about the things that went right. What are you most proud of in your time at Merrill?
I don't know that I would have anything that I would say I was most proud of. But we did a lot of good things. We took a firm that was struggling in 2001, in the aftermath of the market that I described, and was struggling to find a basis for strong performance. And by that I mean being really relevant to clients and relevant in the marketplace in a whole host of areas that were important areas for being able to compete and serve clients at a global enterprise. And I thought that was handled well. In the aftermath of September 11th, I think the firm rose to the occasion and in the subsequent years was able to right itself and performed very well.
How did Merrill, and particularly under while you were CEO, measure its performance?
Lots of different measures of performance. But look, I mean, I always started from the premise of what is it you want to be to whom? And meaning, which clients do you want to serve? How do you want to serve them? And then working backwards from there to make decisions about what resources you needed in order to do that. And then if you got that right, that would lead to lots of good things. You would enhance your reputation with those clients. You enhance your level of business with those clients. You would increase your ability to do business with other clients of the same ilk. And out of that would flow profitability, the right kind of market share for the kind of businesses that you were trying to create and serve, and the rest of it would take care of itself if you manage those things, and you couldn't really dictate the market. And, frankly, to try to manage risk inherent in all of that, because there's no business in the capital markets business that exists without some degree of risk.
How about measuring financial performance of the firm and stock price performance of the firm?
As I say, I thought of it as an output as opposed to an input. Trying to engineer financial performance, starting with what it is you want to achieve from a financial point of view, is got the equation backwards in my mind. And with a market-based business that we lived in, the markets determine essentially what you're going to be able to extract at any given moment relative to what your capabilities are and the level of risk you're willing to assume. It's crazy to start by trying to think about what you want to have the financial performance look like, and then engineer things backwards from there.
And I didn't necessarily mean that. I meant when you were looking at financial performance as an output, were you then, evaluating that or comparing that to either internal targets of the company, the way the other four iBanks were performing, the way other institutions were performing, anything like that?
All of the above. I mean, you look for metrics to look at performance relative to what you've done the year before, from one quarter to the next, relative to what your expectations were by individual business in the aggregate, what was performing, what wasn't performing, what did you look like versus competitors. All that's relevant, but not a single measure. All of it, the totality of it. You try to get a sense for how well we were doing.
One of the things we've seen is that Merrill certainly wasn't alone in terms of growing during the decade of the 2000s. The other iBanks were, a lot of the commercial banks were. Was that part of the calculus, when you were CEO of, there is part of it is keeping up with the Joneses or competing with the other iBanks, commercial banks, or other institutions?
I always thought you had to be able to compete, but not compete in some aggregated sense. Again, which clients do you want to compete for? And how do you want to compete with them? Take our retail business. We had clients everything from $50,000 up to several hundred million dollars. Is that the right spectrum of clients that we want to compete for? Because we're competing with different firms and different offerings and different business models across all of that. Some of those we want to compete for, others we don't, because we weren't geared to do that. So you pick and choose the clients you want to serve, what kind of services you want to have, where you have a chance to meet or exceed expectations frequently. And from that flows what it is you want to measure. So are you doing the things you said you wanted to do in order to compete for that segment? And if you are you achieving the kind of results that you wanted to achieve? But there was no aggregation at a sort of global level. I want to be this big relative to that. A lot of this is dictated by the market.
And on that score, I wanted to ask you, something that we've seen on more of a macro level, in particularly after the dot-com crash and particularly after 9/11, is one, there was a fairly long period of low interest rates, and two, it appears that a fair amount of foreign capital was flowing into the United States. Any comment on either of those factors, on whether it drove demand for the businesses and the products that Merrill was offering?
Low interest rate environment is always good for, almost always good for a financial institution. It depends on why they're there, right? But low interest rates were a stimulating factor in the reflation of the markets after 2000. There's no doubt that that's true. And that, in turn, probably had something to do with the flow of foreign capital into U.S. markets. It wasn't just that. It was the flow of capital across all markets, from U.S. into Europe, into Asia, and Asia into Europe. And that was just part, in part, that was just an evolution of globalization of markets as well. But yes, low interest rates typically is stimulative for investment banking business, although I would imagine right now that's not quite the case.
No. Did you see, or do you recall whether or not you saw in that time frame, was there a larger number of foreign investors that were looking for, whether it's CDOs or other types of investments that were being offered by Merrill?
I don't know that I recall. Something to stood out.
Another thing that we've been looking at that I'm sure won't surprise you are the growth in non-traditional mortgage product, change in underwriting guidelines for those types of non-traditional mortgage product. Was Merrill looking at that as it was offering mortgage-related products to people, and if so, how?
Well, first of all, we didn't underwrite mortgages. We didn't originate them. And I will exhaust my knowledge on the subject with the following comment, which is that we had standards by which we, it is my understanding anyway, standards by which we accepted paper into our warehouse. And those are supposed to be met by the people from which we were buying the mortgages. And there was auditing, spot checking, or sampling that took place of those mortgages. And there were clawback or give-back provisions that were part of the arrangements with all the mortgage providers to the extent there were deficiencies found in the mortgages that were accepted.
You mentioned standards for the paper that Merrill would accept into its warehouse. Were those written standards?
I can't tell you that. I know that.
Okay. You mentioned there was spot checking of the paper that was brought into the warehouse. I take it that was spot checking by folks within Merrill as opposed to an outside firm?
I think so.
Okay. Do you know who?
No.
And then by the clawback provisions, you simply mean buyback provisions if the terms of Merrill's policy for the paper wasn't met?
Correct.
And do you recall whether there was any, change, that you recall in terms of, hey, there's more paper coming in that isn't meeting it and we need to put it back, or our spot checkers are spotting more paper?
I wasn't aware of that.
Okay. Do you recall whether or not the standards for the paper that Merrill would accept in its warehouse changed?
No.
No, you don't recall, or no, it did not?
No, I wasn't aware of that.
Okay.
If it did.
Thank you. Were you involved at all in Merrill's decision to purchase First Franklin that I believe closed in September of 2006?
Yes.
Okay. And describe for me your involvement, please.
Well, like most acquisitions of any size and investments, I forget what we paid for it, but it was more than $1 billion.
It would have come three.
It would have come to my desk for final approval. This was an idea that had been proposed over, many number of months, maybe a year or so, before the acquisition of First Franklin. And if I'm not mistaken, the origins was from the department itself, and the name that I associated with it was Kronthal, who was head of that group at the time. So, and we looked at lots of different opportunities, and this was the one that we finally bought.
And you mentioned you were looking at the possible acquisition of a loan originator for many months. How was it explained to you from Kronthal, whoever, about why it would be a good idea to vertically integrate, essentially, and have your own loan originator?
The mortgage business, largest asset class in the U.S. by far, therefore the largest universe of investors and people who traded in those securities, investors that we serve, important to be in that market. And if you start from that premise, then being able to control our own quality and source of origination thought to be a benefit over a long time.
Do you recall if there was any contrarian voices within the firm saying we should not buy First Franklin?
No.
Okay. I will tell you that I have at least seen that the financial press reported that I believe the word one article was puzzling. The fact that Merrill's acquisition of First Franklin in September of 2006, when there were signs, more than a few signs of problem in the subprime market. Does that jog any memory bells in terms of debate within the company about whether it made sense to buy First Franklin?
No. I don't know if the reports you're referring to are referring to people inside of Merrill or outside of Merrill. It was puzzling to.
It was outside of Merrill. That's the way I took the article.
No, I don't recall any discussions like that.
Okay.
And, I've proven a number of transactions which some people didn't necessarily, on the outside, agree with. I think it's endemic to running a business.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to
show you this document, and I don't worry about the length of it. I only want to ask you about a few pages in it for the record, just so the tape's clear. It is a presentation to the Merrill Lynch & Company Board of Directors titled Leverage Finance and Mortgage /CDO Review, dated October 21st, 2007. The pages I want to ask you about start looking at the base numbers, 77061, the page titled ABS Warehouse /CDO Inventory Chronology.
What are you looking at?
061. This is for you. Okay. So take your time to look at any part of the document that you want, but I guess my first question is, do you recall whether or not you've seen this document before?
I may have.
Okay. And when we were talking earlier today, you had talked about how in July of 07, you had first learned about the retained positions in the CDO, and I think you said that Mr. Fakahani then looked into it and gave a subsequent presentation. I'm wondering if, one, this maybe jogs any memory bells, and is this either these pages I'm having you look at, it's really just these two 61 and 62 pages, or any part of this, do you know whether or not this was what Mr. Fakahani prepared and presented to the board? And again, maybe it's our memory bells, is 3 days before the 3Q07 earnings call.
No. I mean, there was lots of information, lots of data floating around. I don't recall this presentation specifically. I don't even recall who put it together, and I don't recall who made the presentation to the board.
Okay. All I'm going to ask you to do and ask you about is whether any of these entries on these two pages jog any memory bells. So looking at the first third of this page on this PowerPoint deck that's titled Backdrop to Summer 2006,
mm-hmm.
It indicates that aggregate positions at the end of August 2006 are $7.2 billion of CDO's chain positions and another $8 billion. In the warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my first question is, do you recall at that time, in the summer of 2006, that you knew whether or not there was retained positions of $7.2 billion or an $8 billion warehouse? And I don't mean the specific amounts, but just whether or not you knew that generally there were exposures out there at this time frame.
This is 2006, right?
Right. Did I say something else?
I thought you said 7. Right?
If I did, I misspoke. I meant 2006.
Sorry.
I just wanted to clarify the time when you're asking him when he knew.
Right. At the time. In
06.
Not in October 2007,
right.
But at the time in 2006.
So August 2006 is what you're saying. No,
correct.
I wasn't aware.
Okay.
Of what the inventory position was.
Okay, and again, the next bullet indicates that Mr. Ricciardi had just left and there was a strong desire to retain the number one position. We talked about this a little earlier today, but do you recall at that time a desire within the company to retain the number one position?
Was not expressed by me or to me.
Okay. Now, this next bullet, I think we sort of just talked about. Discussion ongoing regarding purchase of subprime mortgage originator, FICC management, bullish on growth, bullish on asset class. First question, do you recall generally whether in the summer 2006 timeframe, FICC management or the company in general was bullish on growth and bullish on the subprime asset class?
I don't know. What I do know is that over a longer time horizon, it was thought that having a mortgage originator was important in the context I described earlier.
So moving now to the second third, late summer to year-end 2006, we've already talked about how Mr. Sammarchi became the head of FICC. But going down to the third bullet, CDO inventory continues to ramp up through year-end, $17.3 billion. And then the next bullet is talking about the warehouse increasing to $11.9 billion. Again, in late summer to the end of 2006, do you recall whether or not you're aware of those increasing exposures?
No.
Okay, and is it accurate to say that at this time, you believe that CDOs being constructed the goal was to completely sell all of them?
Yes, but recognizing that you couldn't always sell all of everything.
Sure. And you'll see that the next bullet here says, in order to execute deals, ML continues to take down senior tranches into inventory. And do you recall whether in the late summer to year end 06 timeframe, whether or not you knew that in order to execute deals, Merrill Lynch needed to retain senior tranches?
No.
Okay. And, of course, I forgot to ask you about something in the first third. That last bullet there talks about Citigroup taking a more aggressive view on senior tranche pricing, AIG retreating as a significant purchaser of senior tranches, and that both of those developments making pricing unattractive and changing certain dynamics in the CDO business. Generally, do you recall discussions in that time frame, you know, not before the late summer of 2006, about either of those developments, Citigroup or AIG?
No.
Moving down to the January to February 07 bottom part of that page, it increases that subprime deterioration becomes increasingly evident, and that the business was focused on that deteriorating subprime market. Yet generally, do you recall in the January-February 2007 timeframe whether or not, whether you were aware or having discussions within the company about the deteriorating subprime market?
No, although, you know, when I do recall asking about a general question about our subprime exposure, and this was recalled to me by in discussions reviewing emails related to some other process. Looking back on those emails, I did ask about our subprime exposure and was reassured by answers that I received from my subordinates.
Okay. So do you recall, is this in the January-February 2007 time frame that you asked about the subprime
exposure? Sometime early in the, sometime around the early part of 2007, yes.
And do you recall who you were asking and who gave you the reassurances?
Well, I don't recall the emails specifically, except maybe one to Dow and perhaps one to Osmond as well. Or to Dow, and Osmond answered Dow, and Dow related to me. Something like that. I don't fully recall the email, but I do recall a sequence of emails like that.
Okay. And you recall those inquiries and assurances being in email communications?
Correct.
Okay. Do you recall having verbal discussions on the same topics with Mr. Kim, Mr. Samerchi, or anyone else?
Yes, it would have been contemporaneous with the email communication. I believe the reason it was in part an email was because I was traveling. I was on the road for some period of time doing that.
I haven't seen the emails you're talking about, but I take it, given what you told us earlier today, those emails didn't say, and by the way, we've got we've got $17.3 million of CDO inventory and $12 billion of warehouse risk.
No, I don't recall what they said specifically, but they did, I'm pretty sure, say that.
Okay. You'll see in the third bullet in this bottom third, it says, consensus view deterioration is confined to the subprime market slash no leakage to CDO market slash subprime market and CDO market are different. Do you recall in email communications or otherwise discussions about whether or not there was a consensus view within Merrill that the deterioration in the subprime market would not leak into the CDO market?
No, I don't recall that.
Okay, and that doesn't jog any memory bells in terms of the email you received from Kim Samerchi or whoever it was?
No.
Okay. And again, the last bullet on this first page says, again, list the positions as of February 2007. And again, they're up from the year end of 06. Same question. Do you recall knowing that at that time?
No.
Okay. So moving to the next page, the March to May 2007 set of bullets indicates there's an active risk mitigation strategy underway and that the attempt is to actively reduce the warehouse by print deals.
did you know about this in the March to May 2007 timeframe?
No.
Okay. And I believe you said earlier that you first learned about this in the July 2007 meeting, correct?
Right. In preparation for that and at the meeting, but in or around whatever that meeting date was.
Okay. Now, the next bullet indicates that, or says, that Merrill Lynch is required to take senior tranches into inventory to execute deals, and that over time, Merrill was required to take mezz tranches to execute deals, and that those mezz pieces needed to be enhanced contractually in order to be made more attractive for sale to the detriment of senior tranches. And you know my first question, did you know that at the time, March to May 2007?
No.
Okay, now when you received the presentation in July 2007, did you learn these specific facts, do you recall?
I don't recall.
Okay, do you recall, regardless of timing, do you recall having any discussions with anyone at Merrill about the fact that it needed to take senior tranches into inventory to execute deals?
No.
And do you recall at any time discussions with anyone at Merrill about the need to take mezz tranches into inventory to execute deals?
No.
And do you recall at any time discussions within Merrill about how mezz pieces need to be enhanced contractually in order to make them more attractive for sale?
Don't recall that.
Okay. And again, going down to the middle bullet, it lists the positions as of May 2007 with the CDOs up to about $31 billion and the warehouse down to $3.5 billion. Again, at the time, which I guess would be late May or early June 2007, do you recall whether or not you knew about those exposures?
No.
No, you don't recall, or no, you didn't know?
No, I didn't know.
Now, the next bullet talks about the market during this period, and those three checks indicate that, one, there was still a market to sell positions, but at a loss, and that there was still a market to sell the mezz positions, but at a loss. Do you recall whether or not you learned in this time frame, March to May 2007, that senior and mezz positions could be sold, but only at a loss?
No.
Okay. Did you learn that at any time?
I don't recall.
And the reason I ask is I thought when we talked earlier, I thought you said that during the July meeting or otherwise, you heard that they just couldn't be sold, period.
Well, this would also, you know, without reading too much into it, would imply that as well. Because this is talking about a period that ended in early May, and it says that it appears that there was still a market, which implies that at some point it didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Which is my recollection.
Sure. And understanding that, and thank you for that, do you recall whether or not you learned at any time that folks at Merrill's told you that, look, we could have sold the senior or the mezz tranches, but we didn't because we could only sell them at a loss?
I don't know that I had that specific conversation. What I do remember is that by the time I come to understand what the positions are, it is very difficult, if not impossible, to hedge, sell, or otherwise reduce or mitigate the risk in any market transaction.
Okay. Now, the second to last bullet on this top says, expectation was that spreads had blown out temporarily, that they would come back in, that the 1998 experience reinforced that view and liquidity was still present. Does that jog in memory bells in terms of discussions at Merrill on that topic, that being the expectation that spreads had blown out temporarily and would come back?
Not specifically, no.
Looking at the part of the bullet that says 1998 experience reinforced that view, I was assuming that was referring to long-term capital management.
It probably was.
Okay, and I think you were. Back to my original notes. Yes, you were at Merrill in 1998. What was the experience in 1998? Was there experience there that spreads blew out temporarily but came back?
Yes.
Can you just describe that for me?
But I want to say it wasn't my view.
Okay.
It would never have been my view. Because for me, the experience as CFO during that crisis was indelible. And I took away some lessons from it. And one of them was... I took away the opposite lesson from this than is implied by this document, which is that yes, spreads did blow out, and they blew out on all kinds of instruments, including ABS. And the crisis that precipitated it had nothing to do with it. The crisis that precipitated was a Russian, Russians defaulting on their debt. And it spread through everything for a period of time. The lesson I took away from it, though, was that had the market seizure and panic and lack of liquidity lasted longer, there would have been a lot of firms across the street that were irreparably harmed, and Merrill would have been one of those. In the event, as it turned out, however, spreads blew out dramatically. They began to return to some semblance of normalcy by the fall. So by around October, the eye of the storm had passed. That was my experience with it. I don't know what other people took away from it.
Let me ask you, if you can answer this, you said you didn't know about the buildup in positions until July of 2007 when you get the presentation. If you had learned about the buildup in positions earlier, would you have done anything differently than what Merrill did?
Yes.
What would you have done?
I would have stopped the level of underwriting that we were doing, so we didn't accumulate additional inventory. And then I would have sold what we could have sold down to some reasonable level where the risk was tolerable. I don't think even then, even in the course of this presentation, I'm not sure that anyone still fully understood the scope of the risk inherent in these securities. And that can be borne out by a whole series of things, which is nobody else had taken any losses on similar size positions, same kinds of paper up until that point. It was only subsequent to this that other firms started to recognize losses there. And as hard as people tried to value these securities, even after it was clear that there was some sort of crisis in the market, it was hard to get the value right because it continued to decline. So these securities were very hard to value, but if I had known that we had built up position, the reason I would have addressed it is would have asked the question, why aren't we selling these? And if the answer was, we can't sell them in the market for a reasonable price, my answer would have been, then stop underwriting. Just the only reason to be in the business is not to be an expression of risk taking. We had businesses that were specifically geared to expressing a view on risk in certain markets. This wasn't one of them.
And again, I'm wondering if maybe this jogs any memory bells of discussions you had with folks either in the time frame leading up to the July 07 meeting or afterwards and up until you leave about why did we let it build up and why did we keep underwriting? And
to be honest with you, I was preoccupied to almost full capacity for about 3 months, August, September, October, with a couple of things. One is, in September, I was traveling all the time. I was in Japan, I was in Europe. These were meetings that had been scheduled for months, and I was on the road for most of September. But in the meantime, I was also trying to manage our way through two things. One was the liquidity issues raised by these positions and the increasing liquidity crisis that was evolving, that started in earnest after the seizure of the markets in Europe in early August. So, and trying to find a way to mitigate, reduce, eliminate, sell, hedge the risk in some way. And third, exploring the idea of us merging with a much stronger, larger competitor who also had deposits as part of their funding base and who were part of the Federal Reserve System, which we were not.
Was that Wachovia?
It was initially B of A and subsequently Wachovia.
Now, you mentioned that you were...
So I didn't have a lot of time for forensics, which I hoped to have the ability to get to later. And it wouldn't have done me much good to spend an enormous amount of time on it contemporaneously, getting those kinds of things taken care of.
You mentioned that one of the things you were dealing with was liquidity issues related to the buildup of the positions.
It wasn't just that. It was also what was going on in the market. It was more what was happening in the market broadly.
And that's what we were talking about before in terms of the repo market.
Right. Okay. But it wasn't just the repo market. It was also the unsecured debt market, commercial paper. Every source of funding became more difficult after early August.
Okay.
For everyone.
Right. And as you probably recall, Countrywide, of course, had a big liquidity problem in August. They had to access their backup line, I think, in mid-August. And then, of course, B of A makes a $2 billion investment. Was that event something that impacted liquidity for Merrill?
I don't think Merrill was an outlier in terms of liquidity at all. And in fact, I think despite the fact that we had taken this significant write-down, pre-write-down, post-earnings announcement, and the environment had deteriorated, we were successful in continuing to fund ourselves. And I think that is because we had done a lot of preparation leading up to it. We did a lot of work during the August, September timeframe to make sure that what we put in place actually worked the way that it was supposed to work. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we had, any exceptional liquidity problems. I think they were broad-based around the market, and I think everyone, to varying degrees, but to a significant degree, felt the pinch, and because the markets were very, very tight.
Okay. If I could
cross this, Jeff, what do you think?
I think we're close.
Yeah.
I want to do this page and then move to the grand finale.
Mr. O'Neill, if I could direct your attention to the next page in this PowerPoint deck, it's a page that's labeled Market Risk Chronology. And again, you'll see at the top of the page it says in early 2007, the director in market risk, MV, who I think is Ming Lee, notes growth of CDO inventory, discusses the issue with his management of the business line, and that after those discussions, Mr. Lee apparently, as market risk management, is made comfortable that the business is aware of the risk, one, two, that the risk is not material given the AAA nature of the position, and three, that stress scenarios do not indicate the position as a material risk. But, then it goes on, business risk management fails to note the growth of the CDO inventory. Market risk management continues to focus largely on the DV01 metric, which was an insufficient metric to evaluate the nature of the risk. And as a result, the growth of the position in aggregate exposure is not highlighted to senior management. My initial question is that concluding bullet. When you find out in July of 07 about the increased position, do you recall whether or not there were discussions along the lines of these bullets about why senior management was not made aware of the growth of the position and the aggregate exposure?
No. Actually, you know, as I look at this document, I can't tell you I actually remember this presentation at all. And I'm not sure why, because it says it was made to the board of directors. I assume it actually was presented. I don't know. But I don't remember this at all.
Okay. Putting aside the slide of it and not recognizing.
At least not while. I don't recall ever having seen this while I was there. But the date 21st would indicate that I was still there.
Sure.
I guess.
And putting aside whether or not you remember seeing the document, do you recall having discussions along the lines of the bullets that are in on this particular page?
Not in July. Subsequently, I had some discussions, not about all of this, but about the DVO1 metric.
Yes. And what do you recall about that?
I was told in September, when I was trying to understand a little bit of how we had accumulated such a position. I had a conversation, at least one conversation, with John Bright, and I asked him about it, and he said that he thought that the DVO1 metric, which was what picked up the risk in the portfolio, didn't adequately explain the nature of the risk.
And why was that? What was his explanation for that?
Because it measured the market, the change in price based on a change in in spread risk or spreads, and that was insufficient to capture the underlying credit risk inherent in the bundle of securities that made up what was ostensibly a AAA rated security.
Is it your understanding that a DV01 metric is essentially a bar measure?
No, it doesn't have to be a bar measure. It is a measure that can be used in a bar calculation, but you can also create scenarios where you make an assumption, as was done, that the spread blows out to levels only once before seen in history, i.e. 1998, where it was, I don't know, 1,200 basis points over treasuries, which no one had ever seen before or since. And then you said, if I shock the portfolio by that amount, what are my losses? Well, those numbers, I don't know what they were, but they weren't, they would have been large, but they wouldn't have been anywhere near. They would have been a fraction, I believe, of what ultimately were the losses sustained on that portfolio. So it wasn't just VAR. It was VAR and scenario analysis, trying to look at 100-year flood kind of statistics and shocking that against today's portfolio.
And did Merrill do that? Did it do shock analysis with the 100-year flood and that 1,200 basis point?
Absolutely. It just turned out the level of the flood was much higher than the last 100 years. Much, 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 much higher.
Okay. Finished with that document. So let me now ask you the general question that we are asking everybody that was in the unique position to live
If I go back to that point, I think if anyone who had been involved had understood that that possibility existed, we would have never had this much inventory. Anyone.
Right. It sounds like you wouldn't have had it anyway if you would have known about it.
That's true. Because I learned the business underwriting things that you couldn't hedge and you couldn't sell at certain points in time. So the only way to protect yourself was to keep inventory small. And the only way to do that was to not take on inventory when you weren't sure or reasonably sure you were going to be able to sell.
Okay. So now I want to ask you the broad question that we've been asking everybody that had the fortune or misfortune to live through the financial crisis. And that is, what do you believe were the primary causes for the financial crisis?
You know, I wish I was smart enough to answer that question, but I'm not sure I am. I go back to the meeting I described to you with all these people sitting around a table, smart people, diligent people, asking the right questions, and having within those organizations both governmental and private, with the benefit of hindsight, all the information that was needed and probably some answers as well. And nobody had them. So I'm not sure, given that experience and given how broad-based this whole event turned out to be and how many institutions and how many lives it touched and how many participants sure how to answer that question.
There's no particular factors that come to mind that you think were...
No, it wasn't like there was a house and one person went and lit a match and burned it down. It was much bigger than that, and it had multiple beginnings, and it had multiple sources, and literally thousands and thousands of participants to create the conditions that ultimately existed by the summer of 2007. I don't know how you forestall something like that. I'm not entirely sure.
What about once you do get to 07 and then you have those conditions? Any opinions on why it had the impact it did? For example, we had the .com. We had the NASDAQ crash go from 5,000 to 2,000 or whatever it was.
That was very
painful.
In the
year of 2000. But it didn't have the systemic implications that we saw in this crisis. Any opinions on why that was the case?
The only thing I would venture is that I think the fixed income business, broadly speaking, is just very different from the equity business. And the breadth of participation across the globe and across all kinds of investors and the size and scale of it versus the U.S. NASDAQ market, which is, I don't know how big it is, but it's a fraction of even the mortgage market, let alone the financial market. The size and scale of the market that was involved here is orders of magnitude greater than the NASDAQ market and touched every corner of the globe and all kinds of investors and all kinds of market intermediaries. That wasn't true in NASDAQ.
I've asked you a lot of questions over the last couple of hours, and I want to give you an opportunity to say anything that I haven't asked you about.
No, the only thing I'd add on the line that you just asked me about is if you look back at 98, the scale of that was much bigger than NASDAQ 2. Again, it involved the fixed income markets. And there may be similar reasons as to why the scale of that was so large. It was shorter duration, but it was significant in a way that most other events hadn't been up to that point.
Mr. O'Neill, thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're going to ask these questions, right?